and of all the harm that era I've done, alas, it was to none but me, and all I've done for want of heed to my memory now I can't recall, so fail to me. Parting glass, good night, and joy be with you.
Okay, that was the Parting Glass by the UCD Choral Scholars. They're in Ireland, an Irish singing group. That is a 500-year-old song, the Parting Glass. It's a very popular Irish song. I mean, my guest today is from Ireland. She's never heard it before, but we won't hold that against her. Her name is Emma McCruden. She's a dietitian and a nutritionist. She's got a degree from Ulster in dietitian degree from Ulster.
Yeah, right? Dietetics degree, yeah.
And she has her master's from Loughborough University. Mm-hmm. And that's, is that also in Ireland?
No, Loughborough University is in the Midlands in the UK, in England.
What's the Midlands?
Well, middle of England, I suppose, okay. Near to Nottingham, Derby, that kind of area.
Okay. So. She currently works at UBC in the School of Kinesiology and also for athletics and recreation. So I wanted to start with, so I play rugby and you worked for Ulster in 2013.
Leinster.
Is it Leinster?
Yeah.
On your profile, I swear it says Ulster.
It's Leinster.
Oh, okay.
So
you worked for the Tigers then?
No, that's Leicester Tigers.
Leicester.
Yeah,
oh my
Leinster
goodness.
Rugby are European champions 2013.
They've got, they're blue and black, right?
They are, yeah, blue and white.
Blue and white.
Yeah,
oh
yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah.
I'm a rugby player and I don't even know this. What was that like?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I mean, it was one of my very first professional jobs in sport, and yeah, really interesting. I mean, I was quite young. I was the only female member of their backroom staff, which was challenging.
Yeah,
it was challenging.
The boys are savage.
they're pretty boisterous, all right. Yeah, I think they kind of liked having a female presence there to kind of rein them in sometimes. When I left, the guy who took my position was a guy, male nutritionist, and yeah, they sort of thought, who's going to keep us under control now?
Oh, really?
The female's gone. But I mean, it was great. It was working in Olympic sport, there's a huge budgetary difference between Olympic sport and professional sport. So you had sort of every tool at your disposal with professional sport, and fantastic experience. And I learned a lot from the coaches and the fitness coaches that I worked with, and the athletes as well. So thoroughly enjoyed
it. You worked for some Olympic sports team?
Yes, yeah, yeah. So
I didn't even know Ireland had Olympic teams.
Well, actually, I crossed the waters for it. I am in Loughborough. I was, I suppose I was invited to apply for a position in the English Institute of Sport, and they supply sports science, sports medicine practitioners to Olympic athletes. So I applied for an internship with them immediately after finishing my master's, and I started working straight away with Olympic bobsleigh and with British beach volleyball and with England netball as well, which is a sport that nobody knows over
I've
here.
I've seen netball.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was in New Zealand, there was a kid,
huge.
Or no, I was in Australia,
yeah,
and there was a boy who wanted to play netball with the girls.
Yeah.
It was so funny. They went to court over it because
really?
They wouldn't let him play because he was crushing these girls.
Wow.
Like, he was destroying them, and he's like, it's sexist, they're not letting me play.
Yeah, the England team, the women's team, because there weren't that many good competitors for them when they were trying to practice or trying to get ready for Commonwealth Games, etc. So they used to play with guys, and it was an injury hazard. Our physio was on the edge of her seat for the whole thing because they were just so much heavier than our females.
And there is a little bit of contact in netball, not a lot.
Yeah, there is.
It's like basketball almost, like you get hit sometimes.
Yeah, and I think any sport where there's jumping and landing around ankles, there's a risk for injury there, and ACL injuries pretty big in netball as well, unfortunately.
Yeah. So the bobsled, What kind of nutrition do they, I mean, are they trying to get big?
It was more skeleton that I worked with. I think I did say bobsleigh, but it was bobsleigh, bob skeleton. So with skeleton, they're basically bent over sprinters, 30 meter sprinters. That's what you kind of think of them as. So their job is to be as light and as powerful as possible. There's a fine balance. Like, they have to be light for that 30 meter sprint, but then they have to be, being slightly heavier helps them with the G-force,
run, right?
going down the run. So there's a real fine balance with those guys. So they're incredibly lean athletes majority of the time, because that's where they lose their weight for the sprint, and then they want to keep their muscle mass as heavy as possible.
So they're like, are they like a lean 230 or are they a lean like 170? What's the...
I work in kilos, not pounds.
Oh, sorry.
I'm still trying to convert that.
230 would be about 107 or 108?
Yeah, they're more so like our heaviest male athlete would have been around 96, 97 kilos.
Okay, so that's like 205.
Yeah, most of the guys would be in their low 80s, and most of the girls ranged a lot from about 50 kilos right up to 70 kilos, and no correlation whatsoever between being heavier and being more successful. We had gold in both Olympic Games with England, and the weights of our top female athletes were very, very different. So,
Okay, so let's move into the diet and nutrition part of the show.
Yeah.
So the first one I've got here is the paleo diet.
Mm.
What do you think about it?
On the spot. I think with the paleo diet...
I think you should go explain what it is.
So,
first.
Well, that's an interesting one, because there's a few different interpretations of what it is, but it's basically trying to eat as our ancestors did many, many years ago. So avoiding any elements of processing whatsoever, eliminating mostly dairy, mostly grains, and any kinds of processed flours. So it's predominantly reliant on nuts, meats, and fruits and vegetables.
Well, I have some issues with it, obviously, but... So the no dairy thing,
mm-hmm.
people have been drinking milk for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. That's really no argument, right?
Yeah, and I think even...
The grain, we've been eating grain for...
Yeah, very long time, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So...
Yeah, I think when you actually look at the paleo diet and some of the components that are part of it, or the comprise part of it... people may have grown up eating in a slightly different way, but that was because they weren't exposed to foods from other areas. And what the modern paleo diet is doing is exposing people to, you know, oranges from California when there are no longer oranges available in Ireland in the summer, for example.
Right.
So there's still an element of processing there, and an element of exposing people to foods that aren't naturally available in their environment.
Right.
So I think the paleo diet is incredibly popular. I think for individuals, human beings aren't very good at dealing with the idea of moderation. I think moderation, if you tell someone on a diet, you can have a small amount of this, you can have a small amount of that. Human beings like rules. They like, no, we work better within black and white. And when you get into the gray, that's where we're in trouble.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the paleo diet is quite popular for people. It reduces calories. That's the ultimate reason as to why it works in the first instance. And I think when you give people a list of foods they can and they cannot eat, it's much easier for human beings to stay within those lanes. Is it healthy? In my opinion, no. And I think a lot of the clientele that we see rebound from the paleo diet, maybe from a short period on it where they've been pretty successful with it, but when they start to re-engage in social activities again and in normal patterns of eating, they have no clue what to do with the real world food again.
Right.
And there are certainly ways that you can manipulate the paleo diet, and I suppose the basic fundamental principle of it, avoiding foods that are processed, that's a lovely concept, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the way I encourage people to eat, minimal processing, but still including carbs and still including calcium and dairy and those kinds of things. But I think if you take some of the basic principles and you manipulate it slightly, we end up with a healthy eating program, really. But that's not as easy to follow for some people.
Yeah, yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned calories.
Mm-hmm.
Is weight loss just about calories in, calories out? Because I know there's still a debate going on, because some people think, oh, I need tons of fat.
Yeah.
and it can be super high calorie, but I'll still lose weight. Or some people think, oh, you need a high sugar diet, and that'll help you lose weight. What is going on there?
Yeah, it's still a calorie. A calorie is still a calorie, yeah. And if any degree of weight loss that we look at is generally related to calorie deficit, your cells are very sensitive to calorie deficit and will mobilize adipose tissue and will mobilize it pretty quickly if you're in a calorie deficit. What you're talking about with eating lots of fat and still experiencing weight loss is generally when people go into something called ketosis, is when they start mobilizing a lot of fatty acids to go through an oxidative process to be used as an energy source for their body. And it comes with a lot of complications. There's a
ketosis does.
Yes, ketosis does. Right. Yeah, there's a big adjustment period to it. There's about a 3 to 4 week adjustment period to it. And I mean complications as in mental health, I mean energy levels, I mean socially, how your environment's going to have to change. You need to be incredibly diligent with the foods that you're eating in order to go into ketosis, for example. Again, the literature has a range, but it's recommended that about 20 to 50 grams of carbohydrates per day is the maximum that you can have.
Really?
And that's an apple, or that's generally eating foods that are higher in fat, like avocado, like eggs, for egg yolks, for example.
Yeah.
You'll get carbohydrates. You'll get that little carbohydrates purely from those foods.
Oh, really?
If you go over and above that, you're technically in a low carbohydrate diet, but you're not in ketosis.
Right. Mm. Okay. Let's talk about some supplements.
Mm-hmm.
I just got them lined up. So the first one, probably the most researched other than protein, would be creatine, right?
Yeah.
And the most verified that it actually works, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to just go quickly on how it works?
Yeah, sure. I just want to kind of introduce this as well by something that I always say. Supplementation is something that by no means is this going to replace a per diet. You know, with creatine, for example, you're maybe lucky to get 2 to 4% improvements in performance. And with improvements in basic diet, you can, you know, improve your performance 70, 80, 90%. So supplements are there to do exactly what they say. They're just supplement an already pristine diet.
Yeah.
And if you can save yourself money by eating better rather than looking towards supplements for help, you're going to improve your performance a lot more. So I always say that. And the second thing I'd always say is with athletes, you have to be incredibly careful about the sources that you're getting these supplements from.
Yeah.
There are a lot of, for want of better description, dodgy people out there producing terrible quality supplements because it's not a regulated industry.
Yeah, they could literally put a dried poo in the bottle and sell it.
Literally do whatever they want. And if they get caught, they can close that business down and they can set up again tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's a bigger, higher level problem that it's still not policed. So be diligent, make sure that you get your information from credible sources. In creatine, and to address your kind of question with creatine, yeah, it has been shown there's about 40 years of good research on creatine, and it does work for individuals who respond to creatine, and that's the key. Are you a responder or are you a non-responder to creatine? Creatine is really, how it works is basically it increases your phosphocreatine stores, which are the first energy source that you're going to turn to do an explosive activity.
ATP, right?
Yeah, your ATP, exactly, yeah. So phosphocreatine stores are decreased by about 80% within the first 10, 15 seconds of activity. And if you need to repeat that explosive movement, like in a rugby game, for example, 20 seconds later, your phosphocreatine stores won't have had time to come back up to that level that you had at baseline.
Yeah.
So by using creatine, we're artificially increasing phosphocreatine stores so that it's readily available as an energy source.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not suitable for all activities. And certainly with creatine, one of the side effects can be a little bit of weight gain. And for some individuals, that's not what they want. Like a marathon runner, for example,
right. Yeah,
not helpful for them to increase their body weight.
And they're doing long
kilos.
Runs.
Yeah, long
anyways,
running,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, anyway. But for intermittent sprint style sports or for sprint sports, yeah, we do commonly recommend that if the diet is good and if we're looking for changes.
Like
in
a 400, that would be perfect.
Yeah,
right?
Perfect. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I've taken creatine. It's never really done anything for me, right?
Yeah.
I never gained weight or got better fitness out of it or anything. So beta-alanine,
yep.
That's less research done on that, right? But that's the one that makes you itchy. right?
Yeah, it can itching. Do. Yeah, yeah. It sort of incites this tingling or niacin, like a flushing of it's a histamine release, really. So if you take it immediately, and one supporter that I worked with, beta-alanine has to get into the cell over a period of weeks in order for it to be effective. So it takes about 6 to 8 weeks for it to saturate the cells. So that flushing that people feel when they're taking it prior to the gym or prior to doing exercise, that's just a side effect that has nothing to do with improving performance.
Right.
So one team that I worked with, I had to get the athletes to stop just taking it once a week before they played, because they like this flushing feeling, like I'm ready to perform. I'm like, there's no scientific rationale for you to use this in that way.
Yeah.
So let's get it being used properly and look at it like that.
That's
so.
In... like NO Explode and pre-workouts and stuff, and guys will take straight dry shots of it and just be tweaking.
Yeah, and just be, and those pre-workouts, I mean, that's a whole other podcast in itself, but those pre-workouts they're a mixture of things that have scientific basis in general, like caffeine, beta-alanine and sugar, but we don't use pre-workouts. The doses in those pre-workouts are not significant enough to have a physiological effect in the way those individual supplements were explored and were investigated.
Right.
They'll give you enough just to get some of those tingles and some of those feelings. But if you want to use them properly, we use them as separate individual supplements, not pre-workouts.
Right.
Yeah.
And they know most people taking those are probably doing it 2 or 3 times a week. So you'll still get the tingle.
Exactly.
Think it's working, right?
But if there's creatine in it, for example, you need to take creatine every single day for it to have an effect. Not 2 or 3 times a week, so you need to take it as an individual supplement.
Okay, that's vitamin D. So we live in the worst place for rain in the world.
Yeah,
there's always clouds. There's no sun for about 8 months. Welcome.
Yeah, nobody told me that when I was moving here.
Welcome. I mean, summer's amazing for about 2 months, but it'll rain all week.
Yeah,
literally all week, all day, all night. So vitamin D is vital.
Yeah.
We get it in the summer, but you don't get it in the fall, especially someone like me, so what's the dose that you would recommend? Obviously you're not a doctor, so you can't say for sure what to do, but
well, it does fall into the dietetic realm to recommend vitamin D, so it is something that
you can't prescribe it, though.
No, but because it's non-prescription, you can get it across, you know, in any pharmacy, so it doesn't need a prescription for it. So I do recommend vitamin D. I think coming from Ireland, I have something in common with Vancouver in terms of where we are in the world. We do recommend vitamin D. There's quite an interesting kind of controversy happening at the moment with Health Canada recommendations and what's going on in the literature.
Right.
So Health Canada in, I think it was 2007, they increased their vitamin D recommendations from 400 international units to 600 international units for adults over the age of 19. And that was based on a lot of data and a lot of meta-analyses, but it is being challenged by some individuals who think that's still too low.
Yeah, I take 4,000.
So 4,000 is at the upper level for that Health Canada recommend for toxicity. So most of us in health practice and in the Olympic realm are following some literature that Liverpool John Moores is producing quite a lot of literature at the moment on athletes and vitamin D use, somewhere around 2,000 international units per day at the moment.
Two.
So doses higher than that for some individuals can it can affect their gut a little bit, and I think 2,000 is somewhat of a happy medium between the upper level and the minimum, the 600 IU that Health Canada are recommending. So it's something to watch, but I think we haven't got complete consensus on what that dose is, but I'm quite comfortable recommending 2,000 from September to March in Vancouver especially.
Yeah.
And then for some individuals, continuing that throughout the summer is something that there's literature on
as
well.
So what are some things that vitamin D actually does? Because I'm like, people say, oh, it just goes to your bones, it helps your bones.
Yeah.
But doesn't it do a whole host of things?
Yeah, right? And I think there's still, that's the general, when you look up vitamin D on, say, Osteoporosis Canada, whatever the websites, it's bones, bones, bones. It is very heavily associated with that. And, you know, we have a population at UBC here are still laying down peak bone mass until they're 23 years old.
Right.
So it's super important that for females especially, once females go into the menopause, we're very very predisposed to osteoporosis. So yeah. I can't emphasize how important your bone health is enough. So calcium and vitamin D, super important. But some of the other actions that it has in the body, it is involved with the immune system. So helping people fight infection is one of its roles. And another one is with muscle strength. There's some data out there. It actually originated in elderly care population who, if they're in residential homes, if they're not exposed to sunlight at all, even throughout the year, if they cover themselves in clothing, but they're brought outside for sun exposure.
Oh, really?
And looking at vitamin D supplementation and grip strength, so improvements in handheld grip strength. And that's where the data originated from, was elderly care. But it since has been replicated in, I know of one study in boxers in the UK, who they've looked at force and at reaction time and muscle strength improvements with vitamin D supplementation. So there's certainly a role for it there.
Yeah. It does some work on some genes too. What are those, the ends of the genes that protect them during replication? What is that called?
Oh gosh, you're testing my
telomeres.
Telomeres, yeah.
Yeah, they help limit the shortening of them during the replication process, right?
Okay, yeah.
And vitamin D does, I'm pretty sure.
Okay,
don't
take your word for that.
I'm not the dietitian, and I'm not a scientist. So. Okay, fish oil. I asked you if you want to talk about it. You said I think it's pretty much everyone knows about it and it's settled, but you said dosing was
a bit
of an issue.
Yeah, I think with people, so I'm not sure how popular it is in Canada, but in back home when I was a kid, we were all given cod liver oil to increase our fish oil consumption, and that's not the way to go because it's super high in vitamin A, and vitamin A is something that because it's a fat soluble vitamin, there are issues with toxicity with vitamin A with very high doses of cod liver oil. So what you really want to look for is a pure fish oil, and the reason why this is a challenge for us is when you look at omega-3 to omega-6 ratios in our predecessors, those ratios ideally of omega-6 to omega-3 should be 2-1. That's what we're ideally looking for.
2 for 3. 1 for 6.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Two for six, and one for three.
Okay. Yep.
Just to keep levels of kind of chronic inflammation under control. And what we face in current modern society, because we eat a lot of processed foods and because we're exposed to, I'm sure, environmental pollutants as well, our ratio is somewhere around 9-1 of omega-6 to omega-3 right now.
That doesn't sound good.
So it's not good. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to increase the amount of omega-3 specifically in the diet. Omega-6 we tend to get enough of, but omega-3s we're trying to increase. And how you do that is you look for a fish oil with a high dose EPA or DHA.
Yeah.
So those are the two types of omega-3s.
Ireland, they say H as well.
Yeah, we do.
Oh,
yeah.
I hate that. I went to Australia and I was like, what is H?
H, yeah. So just make sure if you're taking a fish oil, you're looking for that. I mean, it depends. I mean, DHA is more recommended for, say, women who are trying to conceive because it's so important for brain cell development in a young infant. But for us, most of us are trying to get an EPA-rich fish oil. So somewhere around 800, 1,000 milligrams of EPA is what I would look for. Cheaper fish oils tend to have very low doses of EPA in them. So the more expensive the fish oil is, generally the higher dose of EPA. Which is better because that's what you're trying to increase really in your diet. So yes, it is. It costs a lot more because it's a pure dose of fish oil, but it's certainly worthwhile in my opinion.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the so-called superfoods.
Mm.
So I'll run through some that I know. So there's the kale. Mm-hmm. Kale is considered one.
Mm-hmm.
What are those avocados?
Mm-hmm.
Those are those green things.
Mm-hmm.
What else was there? Acai, I think, was called a superfood for some reason.
Yeah.
What is your opinion on these superfoods?
Yeah, this is kind of...
And where did that come from? Why did people call it...
So I think the term superfoods was not... it was not invented by anyone, I think, in the dietetic realm. It's
definitely some journalist.
It's definitely a headline grabber, superfoods. Firstly, I want to recommend a book that's written by a colleague of mine from Ontario, Jennifer Saigo, that's called Unmasking Superfoods.
How do you spell Saigo?
S-Y-G-O. It is a brilliant eye-opener into the world of commercialism of foods that may have some good scientific data behind them in their purest form, and how manufacturers have taken those words and taken those ideas, and they have produced a food that doesn't have any of those original benefits in it at all. So a classic example is pomegranate juice, which in its purest form is actually a really vitamin C rich food, and it has lots of polyphenols in it. But most of the pomegranate juice that you get on the shelves in the supermarket has pomegranate essence in it, or has such a little proportion of actual pomegranate in it. It's just sugar, water, and a tiny proportion of pomegranate in it. It will do you no good at all.
Right.
So I think that that book is worth a read. I think superfoods, in my opinion, we need to just be careful about throwing that word around. I mean, like kale, for example, like it is a really nice...
Look at what this person wrote. Move over, spinach. You've got some fierce competition.
Yeah. I think like language like that is not helpful really for anyone. Like, if someone is eating spinach and they come to me and they're eating spinach and they're worrying about should they be eating kale rather than spinach, I'm thinking like...
You're not going to say move over, spinach.
Yeah, you don't need to be here. Like that is not... I think we need to remember that all fruits and vegetables, no matter how unfashionable they are, they have huge nutritional benefits. So I look at things, and a dietitian is very much, that's why you don't see us a lot of the time being quite sensationalist about one food or another, because we try to consider the person as a whole. And kale is an incredibly expensive product at the moment.
And it tastes terrible.
And for some people...
Unless you do a bunch of stuff to it.
Yeah, unless you cover it in salt and coconut oil and bake every goodness out of it.
And then put soy sauce on it.
And then put soy sauce on it. And then what do you have? You know, if you're going to eat it in its natural form, it's not to everyone's taste. But I think if someone comes to me and they have a limited budget and they're trying to improve their health, I will look at much more cost-effective foods that they can eat, other than trying to get acai berries and kale and then not being able to afford good quality other fruits and vegetables.
Dead sea salt and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Exactly. So I think with fruits and vegetables, don't forget about other greens. Like, don't forget about spinach. Don't forget about apples. Don't forget about broccoli, which is really cheap and full of nutrients. So just try to bear that in mind when you're maybe being blown away by some of these terms.
Mm-hmm. Like, there's lots of foods that they have on here, and you said like the ones you get at the supermarket aren't as good as, and the first one they've got on here is tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And the tomatoes we buy at Save-On and Safeway here are bullshit. They're green, they're not ripe at all, and they taste like poo.
Yeah.
Or terrible. They have no flavor.
Yeah.
Because they're designed to be able to last a long time on a ship. They're not designed to taste good.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like, look, I'm not going to say don't buy tomatoes at the grocery store. Buy tomatoes at the grocery store if that's what you can afford. But I think there is a big reward to buy fresh, buy local. So look what is around in, you know, we have a great UBC farm here that I know set up a stall outside the bookstore every week.
Yeah.
And there's also a great, another grocer's over on in University Village. And I think if you know, and there's charts online as well as to what buy fresh, buy local, what can I get? How am I going to use what's available in nature right now to get the most nutrients that I can, because it's come from somewhere that's, it's grown locally here. So I think, look, and the tomatoes in the grocery store, like, you're not going to eat them and you're not going to get any benefit out of them.
Right.
It's just that, in Vancouver, if you can buy those at another time of year and they're in season, they're more likely to have more of that natural nutrition than they are if they've been shipped from the States, or if they've been shipped from Mexico, or they've been shipped from South America, where it's natural for them at this time of year, but by the time they get to us, they've gone through some degree of preservation and cooling, et cetera, et cetera. So, so do what you can within the budget that you have, but I think some of those great UBC farm opportunities, I don't think we take enough advantage of them. There's 40,000 people on campus in UBC.
There's a lot.
Like, that farm by rights should not be able to feed, you know, 1% of the population here, but yet I still see them at the end of that market have produce left over
because people don't buy it from there.
Right. And I would say, like, I did this in university because I'm a bit of a food nerd and I love to cook, obviously. I tried to challenge myself. My New Year's resolution in January when I was in university was to buy a new fruit or vegetable every week that I went grocery shopping and figure out something to do with it. So maybe look at UBC Farm, and if you don't know what to do with that, you know, beetroot when it's in its root form is kind of a scary looking thing, go and Google a recipe. Like, baked beetroot is a really easy thing to do.
And it sounds terrible.
It's gorgeous. If you ever get beetroot in a salad, if you ever have it in a salad, it's been roasted. You just wrap it in tin foil and you roast it, and it's great.
Do they put it on burgers in Ireland?
I think it's become really trendy now to do it. They didn't when I used to live there, but I think it's become trendy.
I hate that. Ruins the whole thing. Stains the bun.
It can
the bun's all soggy.
Yeah, it can do, and your fingers get pretty purple after peeling it. But I think just challenge yourself. If you don't know what to do with something, it's a great way to learn how to use some of these local fruits and vegetables.
Yeah. So. What's the craziest fruit or vegetable you ate? What's like what looks super weird? Or like something that we just don't eat, right?
Yeah, well, I think actually recently I went to a cooking class recently, and this is not a crazy fruit or vegetable. For some of you guys, it will be very common.
Yeah.
But I'd never tried persimmon before. I'd never cooked with persimmon before.
I don't know what that is.
And it kind of looks like...
Is that the star one, or is that star
no,
of an anise?
No, it looks like a mixture between like a tomato and a pepper, with at least the ones that we had.
Yeah, that looks super weird.
Yeah, it's really strange, and the taste is really strange as well. It's very incredibly sweet initially, and then it dries your mouth out within an instant. It's very odd. Yeah, it's really odd sensation. But I went to a cooking class last week. I myself went to one, which I just love, and we griddle panned it and then served it with some goat's cheese and pistachio and some balsamic, and it was delicious. But I learned something new certainly last week. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'll tell you the craziest fruit, vegetable, spice. It's a spice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cinnamon.
Oh,
I didn't know this.
Yeah.
Cinnamon's bark.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? I tell people, and they're like, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
That's crazy. We eat bark.
We're eating bark, yeah.
We're eating bark. That's insane.
Cinnamon is something, especially this time of year, it's delicious. And I put sometimes cinnamon sticks into a water bottle, and cinnamon water is lovely to flavor your water.
Yeah.
It's really nice. So try it. Yeah, it's lovely.
Well, I've certainly learned a lot so far. You're listening to Thunderbird Locker Room on 101.9 CITR Radio, coming to you from UBC on unceded Musqueam territory. We're going to play an ad here. Then we'll be back with Emma McCrudden McCrudden. Either one. I'm sure both are fine. Okay, here's the ad.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
We're back on the Thunderbird Locker Room on 101.9 CITR Radio, coming to you from UBC on unceded Musqueam territory. Our guest today is Emma McCrudden. Let's talk about some more nutrition. Okay, so you worked with a swimmer here named Erin Stamp. I had her on a few weeks ago.
Okay.
And she talked about the FODMAP diet that you had her on.
Mm-hmm.
What? I don't know off the top of your head, but what's that stand for?
And
what does it entail doing?
It's a jumble of words. So in short, it's fermentable sugars. What it actually stands for is fructooligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols.
Oh, of course. So, that was my first guess.
Yeah,
so.
I know. Yeah, that's like, it's a pop quiz question. Everyone should know that. But it's basically fermentable sugars. So the FODMAPs diet is something that has gained a lot of momentum in recent years because of issues with irritable bowel syndrome and issues with people having digestive health problems. And I think in the past, most people, their immediate impact or their immediate go-to if they had some digestive health issues was, I'm going to go gluten-free.
Right.
And a colleague of mine called Dana Liss, she's Canadian and did her PhD in Tasmania on gluten and gluten intolerance and wheat intolerance and does it affect athletic performance.
You can get a PhD in Tasmania?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. she started to look at the impact of people who are non-gluten sensitive and following a gluten diet, do we see improvements in performance, etc., etc.?
Right.
And a lot of that data is still to come out. But
there's quite a bit of controversy over that.
There is quite a bit of controversy with it, but I think what some of us have realized is that within dietary health issues, and man oh man, our digestive systems are super complicated things to figure out. Like, yeah, we're really at the mercy of trial and error with dietary, with digestive health issues. So the FODMAPS plan is a very sequential withdrawal and reintroduction of certain foods over a 6 to 8 week period until we figure out the irritant food. So you're trying to narrow it down to maybe one of those groups of foods or one or two of those groups of foods, and then you're trying to see if you can identify specific foods, either if they're eaten at a certain dose or if they're eaten frequently or if they're eaten at all, how that individual can tolerate them. And I think a lot of dietitians are now turning to FODMAPs to try to help people to figure those digestive health issues out rather than immediately gluten-free, because the problem, I think, with gluten products is that when someone goes gluten-free, they're usually taking away a lot of other foods by association. So if you're taking away like pasta, for example, like there's eggs and flour in pasta, and if you're buying pasta off the shelves, there's preservatives in that pasta as well, other weird things. Yeah. So it might be the gluten, but it might not be the gluten.
Right.
So FODMAPs allows you a way of maybe figuring out other irritant foods without being that kind of extreme to withdraw an entire food group.
Mm-hmm. I think Aaron's was mushrooms, right?
It was, yeah. It was. And we figured that out, I think, in about week 3 or 4. But we still continue to follow the process the whole way through. And it's very intensive. Like, she's a fantastic athlete and a fantastic individual, incredibly diligent. Some people find it quite hard to stick to these plans because your first week does include withdrawing quite a lot of foods and then slow, gradual reintroduction. So you've got to be prepared for a 6 to 8 week kind of intervention. And we met every single week and went through the foods that she tried and not tried and how she responded to some of those. So it takes a lot of effort on the athlete and the practitioner's part, but to the best of my knowledge, and Erin can confirm that or not, but she hasn't had any issues since, and that's a big relief when someone finally finds out what the irritant food is. That's a huge relief to them.
People are weird like that. Like, some people can eat, I can eat peanuts all day, mm-hmm. all day, every day. Mm-hmm. Some people get a whiff of it and they go into anaphylactic shock and they might die.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
It is kind of crazy.
God. The human body is so weird.
The human body is, I mean, it's amazing, but I think my
it's
profession.
It's a terrible design.
Oh my God, it's an amazing design.
No,
like,
way.
The things that we do is, I don't know how our body does all of these things at once, but I think that's probably the. Nutrition is very much an art and a science mixed together, and I'm sure people can say that for a lot of disciplines, but textbooks and cell research and lab research will tell us one thing, and my job and any dietitian's job is to try to take that information and put it into real life with real human beings who have lots of other things and stressors going on in their lives, and it's a really, really complex thing to figure out. And don't get me wrong, it doesn't always work out perfectly, and sometimes it takes people to come back to you again and again, and sometimes we have real problems figuring things out, or if there's lack of commitment on the individual side, or life gets in the way and they can't follow a certain diet plan. But I think the most successful people with any dietary intervention or any diet plan or any nutrition plan are people who follow it consistently. And consistency is the absolute key word for nutrition. So.
Okay, speaking of consistency, let's move to veganism,
because
those people are very consistent and persistent.
Yeah.
Is that, do you feel like it's healthy to live? Well, obviously, it depends on how deep you go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But obviously, you can do it and be fine, right? Yep. That's established,
right? You can,
right?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Like, there's guys who run marathons who are vegans, even.
Yeah, very, very healthy vegan athletes out there who are pushing their bodies to the extreme. Yeah. So, yeah, of course.
So like, what are the things they need to do to be able to train like that on a diet that has nothing in it?
Yeah, so this is going to be a very quick overview, and I'd say to anyone out there who's following or thinking of following part semi-vegetarian, vegan, vegetarian, whatever, go and see a dietitian. Go and see someone who can guide you through this, because getting advice from the internet or from a friend who's vegetarian or vegan is not good enough for you. So make sure you're getting appropriate advice. And I think with veganism, I think I try to understand why a person is following that lifestyle, first of all, because there may be some other issues going on in terms of relationships with food and just trying to figure those things out.
Okay.
There's evidence around that. But certainly if an individual animal rights wise or personal opinion or environmental reasons, I support it. You know, that's their choice. And it's my job then to try to help them through this and make sure they're getting all of their nutrients. So we tend to, without drilling down too much into it, protein is obviously a huge problem for vegans. So trying to make sure that they're meeting their minimum requirements for the level of activity that they're at. And Vancouver, because of the nutrition movements that there are in Vancouver, there are certain countries in the world where this would be a real challenge. But Vancouver has a lot of really good restaurants and good products around that will suit that lifestyle. So you've got to make sure that they're meeting those basic energy needs, basic protein needs. Generally, carbohydrate needs are pretty good because they rely on that for a lot of energy. And then you drill into maybe some other micronutrients like calcium can be a challenge. So making sure they have that. B12 can obviously be a challenge as well. And then there are some other, in terms of performance areas, like we spoke about creatine and beta-alanine.
Right. Creatine's in red meat, right?
Exactly. In meat products.
In meat.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And beta-alanine is the same. So when I've worked with vegan athletes in the past at the high level, they will be on those supplements as well to support training. So lots and lots of things. But I think first and foremost, make sure you're getting some professional opinion and professional help.
Let's go to Eating on Campus. So you guys made this website. Mm-hmm. It's on the UBC site.
It is, yeah. So it's on the Go Thunderbirds website. So if you go to Go Thunderbirds and it's under Department and Athlete Nutrition, you should be able to pull up the...
Oh, I've got one question though.
Yeah.
So you worked with Leinster.
Yeah.
2013. That's a rugby
confirmed.
Team.
Yeah.
Why don't you work with our rugby team?
With
we
the
don't
Canadian,
get any help.
The
no,
Canadian
no, no, no. Not the Canadian
they
men's
support.
Team. The one that has a clubhouse right here on campus.
Yeah.
I've never seen you there.
So
why is that?
As you alluded to.
We get no
to,
love from the athletic department.
As you alluded to at the start, my role is pretty full on. So I'm 50% with the kinesiology department and 50% with the varsity athletics teams. So it's a 50% role. There's 640 athletes on campus. So each team is entitled to service for me, and actually the rugby team are in for their first cooking session, which should be hilarious.
Have a cooking session?
Well,
when is that?
It's in February, but we're limited in numbers, so over to your coaching staff to talk to you guys about that. But
it's going to be a fight for that.
Yeah, we do, and I've two brilliant dietetic students, Cara and Terry, who help me out with that every other Tuesday. So we've put 10 university teams through that so far this season, this year, and we'll do another 7 next term. It's a pilot project, so fingers crossed we get more funding and more money for it next year, because I fundamentally believe that cooking your own food and being aware of what goes into your food, and I think that helps budget, I think that helps nutrition, your whole nutrition approach. And I think I have been quite shocked and then impressed at the levels of skills that I've seen in the kitchen. And it blows my mind how people think that they can perform at a high level if they don't know how to cook some basic meals.
Right.
Because you're either going to suffer on quality if you're eating out all the time. And we can try to eat the healthiest food in the world, but if you're eating out at a high quality place, they certainly use extra salt, extra fat, extra, you know, some of the protein serves are obnoxious in some places that people eat out in. So you've got to be able to make some basic quick meals as a student athlete to save your money and also to get what you need out of your nutrition. So I think fundamental cooking skills to me is an absolute basic. And I also want to give a plug to, we have some student dietitians on campus here who are trained to give any single student on the UBC campus a grocery tour at the grocery store that we have on campus.
So any student.
Any athlete, any student.
Any student athlete.
So how they get access to that is nutrition.tours@ubc.ca. And you contact that email and you can book in groups of 6 or 8. And these students will We'll take you around the grocery store for 45 minutes to an hour and answer as many questions as you can throw
at
them.
That's quite a while.
Honestly, it seems like quite a while. I used to tell most athletes that we'd be there for 30 minutes, and an hour and a half later, they were still throwing questions at me. People just get really into it. They're like, they're just picking up foods, and what about this? And I eat this, and what do you think? They get really into it. So I would say go, and the uptake hasn't been as big on that as we would have hoped. And I am gobsmacked about that, because there are so many sessions available in the week. Go once in the year. You might learn something. You will learn something new, and it's going to set you up for not only now, but for future life as well.
Yeah, so I don't think they really advertised it that well, because I only heard about it weeks after it had been implemented.
Right,
and I'm
right.
on one of the varsity teams. Highly doubt some guy who just goes to chem class every day knows about it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a huge opportunity. We're meeting up in a couple of weeks to talk about that. It's in the residences on campus as well, but posters and I've told coaching staff about it. Every presentation I do, athletes are told about it as well. But I think it deserves a lot of attention, because it's a massive opportunity for any student here to figure it out. So, yeah.
Okay, let's go through this a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you got sleep and recovery here. Do you know a lot about sleep?
Well, I think as part of the, I'm certainly not a sleep expert. There are people on campus who are much more au fait with the literature than me. But I think as part of my screening, I will go through sleep with an athlete, because it has a big impact on recovery, and it has an impact on appetite regulation as
well. So I worked out at 7 last night.
Okay.
I went to bed at 2 in the morning, and I got up at 7:30. Is that good?
Why are you awake until 2:30?
Because I had another show last night, and then I went home, and then I was just chatting for a few hours. God.
I mean, yeah, look, with sleep, I think the human body, it's an amazing piece. We've already said that. It can cope with a lot. Like, we're pretty resilient.
Yeah.
So one night of less than our ideal 8 hours sleep is, we're not going to, you know, collapse in the corner after that. We can survive. Of course we can. People do some crazy things, like new mothers do crazy things on less sleep than that. But over time, that will start to eat away basically at your ability to concentrate and your recovery and all those kinds of things, and your immune system as well, which is a big, big focus for student athletes on campus, like getting sick around Christmas and September and again in January. It coincides with exam stress. It coincides with a lot of challenges that you face on campus, but it sure does impact your performance at school, and it certainly does impact athletes' performances. So get sleep when you can.
Is beer good for recovery?
No.
No? I saw a study that said have a beer after a game.
Yeah, that was probably one of the most publicized studies in the world ever, because newspapers are great to publicize, chocolate is good for you, and eat as many calories as you want.
Good
and
news
drink
for
beer
egg lovers.
Exactly. So, you know, just, no, it's not good for recovery.
Okay.
Too much of anything is not good for recovery.
Okay. So let's do the nutrition for travel section. Mm-hmm. So when I come to campus, most of the time I'll just have a bag of almonds.
Okay.
And coffee.
Yeah.
And just eat those until I can't eat anymore. Is that okay? Because I'll breakfast and then I'll do that and then I'll eat dinner.
Yeah. So, well, with almonds, you're getting a large amount of fat and you're getting a little bit of protein and not any carbohydrates. And you're getting lots of nutrients in almonds, but you're not getting a wide plethora that you would if you had some vegetables in there as well and some fruits and stuff.
I had cheese and crackers as well and a can of tuna with it.
Okay, so that's upping your protein intake and your carb intake a little bit more.
Yeah.
Unless you're getting quite a lot of fruits and vegetables like breakfast and dinner, you could do with bringing some fruits or vegetables.
I usually
in
do
there as well.
Spinach with the eggs.
Perfect,
in the morning,
great. Yeah, that's
and then
great.
Spinach again at night. I'll have an apple or something. And I take vitamin C pills.
Okay, okay.
As
so
well.
You're at about 3 servings a day, so you could definitely increase that to 4 or 5, yeah.
Okay. I'll try, but it's probably not going to happen. Okay, on the road, traveling. What are we doing?
Yeah, so this is really designed for athletes who are traveling. Obviously, you guys compete across country. So how you can be better prepared. And this is, I know, a big bugbear of coaches as well, that athletes are not really, don't seem to be turning up. And there's exceptions, but a lot of athletes don't seem to turn up for travel for a weekend with food that they need. Mm-hmm. They rely at highway stops, which is fine. You can get some good things at highway stops. But if you're starving and you're very easily influenced by salt, fat and sugar at those stops, you're probably not going to pick the healthiest option there. So trying to be a bit more prepared, what you can bring to the airport, what you can bring in packed baggage or what you can bring on a coach, making sure you're hydrated, making sure you have things like hand sanitizer with you because you don't want to get sick on the road, and all the little extras that you need. The nutrition for travel sheet will have that in there.
Yeah, so it's got like sports bars, oatmeal, some dried
canned
fruits,
tuna, dried
muesli
fruit.
And stuff like that.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And water.
And water.
How much water do you need? 8 glasses? 4 liters?
Well, it depends on your level of activity, but no, certainly not 4 liters if you're not doing very much activity.
Some people carry a jug around all day.
It's somewhere between 2 and 3 liters. So 2 liters for a female, 3 liters for a male. But then if you're a very heavy sweater, you'll need more on top of that, obviously.
Heavy sweater.
Yeah, very heavy sweater.
We got a couple of those in the room.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So eating on the road and eating in like a fast food restaurant other restaurants.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the ones on campus, we've got Tim Hortons down by the FP Innovations in the wood, the forestry department, the wood department.
The wood department.
So what can you get at like a Tim Hortons that's decent other than the coffee?
Yeah, so we have a section on that website that I'd say anyone can check out as well called Campus Eats. So if you go back a page, there's, so I think it's a little bit further down on that page. Oh, maybe...
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah. So if you go to Campus Eats,
you've got it zoned and everything.
Yeah.
Look at this.
The first thing you need to click on is UBC map, and that pulls up a map of the UBC campus, and you can see letters on that map that tell you what zones each corresponding PDF or each PDF corresponds to.
Mm-hmm.
So if you then go back into the homepage, you can then click on Zone A, Zone B, Zone C, or whatever.
Okay, let's go to the village because that's got the most.
So yeah, it does. Yeah, and what we did was we I had a team of about 8 dietitians over the summer looking at this. And don't get me wrong, this is rough and ready. Like, we have not gone through every single outlet on campus and analyzed their exact ingredients, their exact recipes. We've not done that. We've looked at it as if individuals are walking into a restaurant, what should they choose most often in that facility and what should they try to stay away from or choose once in a while.
Okay.
So within that you'll have lots of different choices in the village, and we've tried to make sure or try to give some educated guesses. I mean, we've certainly not eaten every single thing on these PDFs as well.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there's some things in there that if you got them, they have a lot of sauce on them or they have whatever on them. But this combined with the eating out, the general guidelines on eating out in any restaurant should start to inform some individuals about what might be better for them to choose more often and less often.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of them, the deep fried is in the choose less option.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The tempuras, which is deep fried as well.
Deep fried as well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The dessert. The desserts.
Yeah.
No dessert.
Yeah. Bear in mind, this is on the Go Thunderbirds website as well. And it's not no. I was very clear
on gyoza?
That.
No gyoza? Are you kidding
no,
me?
No, it was not. I was quite specific on that. It's choose most often and it's choose
chicken karage.
Less often.
Chicken karage. Choose less often.
So choose less often or just think about it. Do I really need the extra fats, the extra calories in this? So, yeah, there might be some
scones.
Heartbreaking moments on there.
Scones. Those, you know, scones are actually called scones.
I call them scones. Pronunciation again.
Okay. Bacon and egg breakfast sandwich. Are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm. So which facility
that's
is
in
that
the
from?
Choose less option.
Well, choose
the
less.
The Boulevard Roasting Company.
Yeah, I think like that's an interesting one because for most people, like bacon and eggs, like, and it's a great breakfast, but with bacon, we have to be careful because it is a highly processed meat. The nitrate content in bacon can be quite high, and that is, there's research out there associating that with higher risk of colon cancer.
Whatever.
So if you want to choose bacon, I would say try to choose nitrate-free bacon. You have to look
can you
at
get that?
Some, yeah, you can. You just have to look at some labels in the grocery store.
Probably costs twice as much.
It's not as expensive as you would think, but I mean, all of this, you know, your health is important, and the cost of that is all related to how healthy you want to be. But
I eat a lot of bacon.
Yeah, and I think young males in particular, like, you just need to be careful. There are other ways you can get protein in at breakfast. certainly bacon and eggs, I mean, when you're talking about 20, you probably need 20, 30 grams of protein at breakfast. If you're having whole grain toast and 2-3 eggs at breakfast, you don't need the extra bacon. You don't need any more protein.
Yes, you do.
No, no, you definitely do not. Fact,
everyone
don't.
Listening, don't listen to it.
Fact, you do not need the extra bacon. You do not need the extra bacon. But maybe once a week, if you wanted to have that as part of a breakfast, that's entirely your decision. But it's certainly not something every single day people should be having for breakfast in the morning.
Okay,
no.
I'll consider
Thank you.
Cutting down on
I'm
that.
Saving your life one piece of information.
So I do, I also sometimes, so do you think whole milk's better than like skim milk or 2% or 1%?
Well, I think 1% milk or 0% milk are milks that I don't really
it's
tend
just water,
to
basically.
Recommend. Yeah, I don't really tend to recommend them unless there's I tend to not be dealing with a population here who have cardiovascular disease or cardiovascular disease risk. So I would go for generally 2% myself. And then from a calorie point of view, if someone's really struggling to put on weight or to gain weight, homogenous milk has more fat in it. So it's a great way to mm-hmm. boost calories. So,
yeah, I drink yeah. whole milk. Sometimes I'll do for breakfast like a granola.
Mm.
With whole milk,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
like cereal
yeah.
almost. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm, mm-hmm. what's that? Is
so,
that all right?
Or? So yeah, it's good. I think just with granola, people just need to be careful. Like granola, if it's the super crunchy, like tastes like sugar one, mm-hmm. there's sugar in that. It's
yeah.
been those clusters.
No,
are
I toasted my own oats.
Oh, that's. I was just going to yeah. say that. Or the other thing that I try to get people to do is maybe buy that granola if they like the sweetness in the morning, but mix it with some nuts and seeds and oats that has no sugar in it. So you get more bang for your buck, but you also get less sugar in your breakfast mm-hmm. cereal, and that's certainly a way to wean yourself off having such a big sugar hit first thing in the morning, because each of those little clusters is held together with melted sugar.
Yeah.
You can get a lot of sugar in some of those granolas, so just mm-hmm. be careful.
And there's yeah. sugar in milk too, right?
Yeah, exactly. It is. It's a natural sugar, so it is a lactose natural sugar, so it is slightly different to artificial sugar, but yeah, you'll get a little bit yeah. of sugar in
I had a buddy in high school who made himself lactose intolerant.
Yeah.
I honestly didn't even know you could do that. He drank a liter a day and then he's done for life now.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, he might find that like lactose intolerance is a really, it's a very interesting area. And a colleague, an old master's colleague of mine, is doing a lot of research into what effect actually processing has had on lactose intolerance. So if you have milk from cows that like Jersey cows are the classic that's always held up as these kind of revered cows that have minimal, that, you know, they eat pasture, they grass, and they have very, very healthy lifestyles. They're not over milked. Their milk is very heavily controlled. And looking at how individuals who have lactose intolerance or think they have lactose intolerance respond to that milk versus processed milk. And
like pasteurized milk?
No, like milk.
So are they just drinking it raw?
So no, it is pasteurized. It is still, Jersey milk is pasteurized,
yeah.
but it's not been exposed to the same level of over-milking, which results in things like mastitis, which then means that the cows have to get antibiotics in their
right.
milk. So they're very considered very kind of pure cows. And actually, the response is quite different. People seem, or in this initial kind of pilot study, the individuals who thought that they were lactose intolerant tolerated that milk quite well. So it's not to say that lactose intolerance doesn't exist, and it certainly does exist, but it may be more to do with, as you alluded to, quantity, volume, where you're getting your milk from, and how your body's responding to some other elements within that milk rather mm-hmm. than the lactose itself. So
it looks like they went to McDonald's and
they looked
at everything that tastes good and took it off
yeah,
the menu.
That was
except
definitely.
Except for the Egg McMuffin.
That was their
and
directive.
And they had the Egg McMuffin with the ham and not the one with the sausage or the bacon.
Yeah, that was their directive that to do that.
That is devastating.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything that tastes good is not there.
Yeah.
Oh.
I disagree. I think that you can...
Pita Pit looks good though.
Over time, I think
everything
when you start eating a little bit healthier and you start removing some of these like huge processing and you know, foods that are very heavily processed from your body, I think your taste buds change. We know our taste buds change a lot, and I think
want
you start
them to change, though.
Appreciate these foods a little bit more.
Okay.
Want and need are two different things.
That's true. Oh, booster juice.
Mm.
So what do you think about those juices?
Yeah, so I mean what I said to in a class I was teaching last week, big picture thinking is a big thing for me. So if someone comes to me and they're not eating any fruits and vegetables whatsoever, but I can get them to drink a smoothie with fruit in it, in the big picture, in the grand scheme of things, that's great. They're increasing their fruit and vegetable intake. I'm not as much of a fan of the juices as I am of smoothies, because with juicing, we tend to lose a lot of the fiber in a fruit or vegetable. Mm-hmm. Like all of that gets chucked out and you just take the juice from it.
The sugar basically
from it. So I think smoothies are a little bit better than juices because you get more fiber in them and you get like the whole fruit or vegetable in there. But I think with any juice company, it's very important, or any smoothie company, they must be using the whole fruit. These smoothies that have a fruit juice, which is basically a syrup that they're taking from the fridge and putting into a smoothie.
I think Booster Juice does that with like pineapple.
With some of them, yeah.
And
with
mango,
some of
I think,
them.
Too. Yeah, like mango juice is just straight sugar,
it's
right?
just straight sugar. So try to make sure that you're actually getting fruit in there, and then make sure that there's a little bit of protein in there, whether that's from a milk or whether it's from a protein powder. If you're athletes, make sure it's a tested protein powder. That's really important. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just to make sure you're getting some protein, some natural fruits in there, and then I think it's okay, and I think it is okay in the grand scheme of things.
Competition nutrition. Mm-hmm. What is in this section?
So this is just maybe what you might need to eat before competition. So trying to give some general guidelines on fueling up for competitions of different durations and different intensities. And I mean, this sheet is it's an overview of it. Like a lot of athletes who come to see me individually, I'll work through some specifics with them individually. But yeah, it's just to give people an idea of what to avoid and what to have before competition and what's important for them.
Are you in the carbo loading camp? That was huge a few years ago.
Yeah, it really depends on the sport. Like it really does. Like majority of sports that last less than 90 minutes or so don't need carbohydrate loading in its classical sense, which is 10 grams of carbohydrates per kilogram body mass, and that's a lot of carbohydrate to take on. So if I'm working with a triathlete or an Ironman, then obviously it's a different scenario, but most of us will be able to get enough carbohydrates into our system to fuel activity that lasts for about 90 minutes. If you're running marathons, if you're in activity that lasts a lot longer, then there's an element of carbohydrate becoming more important. But yeah, I think, and then all the other scenario as well actually is if athletes really struggle to eat on competition day, which can be a problem through nerves and nausea and that kind of thing, that we would look at fueling up the day before.
Did you play any sports when you were younger?
No.
None.
Not competitive sports, which
and
is
this
interesting.
Is what you got into.
Yeah, I swam. Until I was a teenager, and then decided that I had more important teenage things to do. And I run a lot now. I run half marathons and just finished another marathon a few weeks ago. So
a full marathon?
Yeah, full marathon. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are you going to dabble in those big long ones?
The ultras. I think my husband might have something to say about that. That's like I get up to train sometimes at 5 o'clock in the morning before work, which is already insane.
Yeah,
so,
you got to watch your sleep.
Yeah, and if you want to make sure that you're training well for an Ironman or for an ultra, then you're doing that quite a lot during the week with a full time job. I know very few people who've managed to do those who have a full time job.
Yeah,
so
I don't think. Yeah, it doesn't really sound feasible.
No. Yeah.
Okay, I think we're gonna wrap up.
Okay.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Emma McCrudden, dietitian at UBC. Where do people find you? Like, where's your office?
So I have two offices. I live two lives. So one of my offices is in Osborne Building 2, which is the kinesiology element of my role. And the other office is in War Memorial Gym in the Athletics and Recreation Corridor. And my email address is on the website as well.
Okay. Do you have Twitter? Are you active on Twitter?
The
tweets?
I am not a huge Twitter
person. Tweet? Everyone I ask doesn't tweet. It's awesome. I love Twitter.
I follow people on Twitter. I follow scientists on Twitter because it's great.
I follow like Bill Nye and stuff like that. And Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, yeah. For useful information, I follow people on Twitter. But then you will see posts on the UBC Performance Instagram from me every once in a while. So I'm kind of under their banner.
Okay.
Myself and the strength and conditioning team post to that quite a bit.
It's your turn to pick a song. Let's see it.
Oh, dear.
Impress me.
Impress you. Okay. So
it can be food related if you want.
Oh, no. Let's not. Let me see. So if my husband hears this, he'll love it. We were very lucky to go to Desert Trip down in Palm Springs a few weeks ago.
What's that?
Which is it was dubbed Old Cella, so it's Coachella for old people. Old Cella. It was a collection like the Rolling Stones, The Who, Paul McCartney, Neil Young, all those kind of guys.
That sounds like Old Cella.
It was pretty awesome, I have to say. We were lucky enough to go to that a few weeks ago, so I'm going to pick a Neil Young song,
okay.
And he's Canadian, which is nice. Yeah. So I'll pick Harvest Moon.
I honestly haven't listened to much Neil Young.
Oh.
Is that a sin?
It's a sin in my house. He's like literally on 24/7.
Okay, here we go. Oh, no, it's not that one.
My name is Chase Kelleher. You've been listening to the Thunderbird Locker Room on 101.9 CITR Radio. That was Emma McCrudden. This is me signing off for 2016. We're coming into 2017 hot, ladies and gentlemen. Coming in hot. Here we go. Have a wonderful evening. Goodbye.
Hey there. My name is Callum Ng, the Executive Director of BC Athlete Voice. We're an athlete-focused organization helping British Columbia's athletes become their best. How do we do that? Well, if you're a BC athlete, we can help you with pretty much everything related to leadership, advocacy, and education. For example, we can help you find funding, start a new athlete group, or develop better public speaking skills. It's all at bcathletevoice.ca. And don't forget to look for us on Twitter and Facebook by searching BC Athlete Voice. Check it out.